The doctor-patient relationship is one that requires communication and trust. But Dr. Norton Hadler says in modern medicine, physicians have less incentive to spend time with their patients and establish those relationships. He says being a doctor today means facilitating a patient care assembly line. Instead, he says doctors should provide informed medical decisions based on relationships rather than algorithms or profits. He examines the history of the doctor-patient relationship in his new book. It's called By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physician. He's an emeritus professor of medicine and microbiology immunology at UNC Chapel Hill and the author of many medical books. This is his latest. Welcome back, Norton Hadler. Good to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation, Frank. It's a pleasure to be back.
In the book, you really detail the kind of the helter-skelter way that we've kind of constructed this medical system of ours, much of which is based on good intentions and unintended bad consequences, I guess.
Well, the book looks at basically the history of the doctor-patient relationship since 1950, and there have been very dramatic changes, most of which happened without our awareness. They sort of become the way we do it, the common sense, the context of going to the doctor. Prior to about 1970, our country was not that different from sister countries. The doctor-patient relationship was paternalistic, if not imperialistic. I doctor, you patient, I talk, you listen. And the basis for the talking tended to be a combination of experience and what was handed down by gray-haired mentors. And the reason that was the way we had it is there was no option. That was the best that we could do. It even occasionally had virtues, but it often didn't. And everybody expected that when they went to the doctor. And then something wonderful happened. We started to have a science develop that made it possible to ask, what's the limits of certainty? And that science came into being actually in the Eastern Caliphates in the 11th century, but it actually gains traction after World War II. And was available to a whole new generation of doctors trying to do justice by their patients. The ability to ask, am I really doing well for the patient? And that actually gets codified by two very important statutes that were written in the late 60s and implemented in the early 70s. And they were long overdue. One was the Kefauver-Harris Amendment to the Food and Drug Administration Acts. The Kefauver-Harris Amendment said, okay, we have the FDA trying to make sure that things are not mislabeled and that things are relatively pure and that they're not contaminated with things that might hurt you. But the amendment said, now we want to see that they have efficacy. So from here on in, you can't license a drug unless there's substantive information, science, that it will actually do right by the patient.
That sounds like a very good idea.
Long overdue. Mm-hmm. The other statute was Medicare. Here we were, boy, we were almost 60 years behind Europe and other progressive nations in saying out loud, our elderly were treated poorly and were abandoned and were left to their own devices in a very wealthy country that should be able to do better. And Johnson had the Medicare legislation to pass through Congress. And he passed it. But the problem with both of these long overdue statutes is they had unintended consequences, and the unintended consequences were built into the legislation of both.
So talk about Kefauver-Harris and this FDA efficacy. We want it not only to be safe but effective.
That's right. The proof of efficacy sounds simple, but there really wasn't a good idea how to do it. In fact, that amendment created the modern generation of biostatisticians. We knew we needed to do randomized controlled trials. We knew we needed to figure out that the drug that we were going to offer was safe and did something for some portion of the population that they wouldn't be afforded if they didn't have the drug. That part's easy. The hard part is how much something and how often need it work. And there was no precedent for that kind of questioning. and an evolution in the answer that is very responsible for the current doctor-patient relationship. And let me step back a bit to the Medicare, the chink in the armor of Medicare. The only way LBJ could get that through Congress was to compromise with the AMA. Back in that time, the AMA was a guild with power. Now it's a real estate holding company in Chicago, and most of the power is to subsidiary guilds. The compromise that Johnson came up with is he said to the guild hall, okay, you give me Medicare so I can do something right for the elderly in America. And in exchange, I'll let you decide who needs to be treated by what method and at what price. Seems like a reasonable compromise, and there was no precedent for sorting that through either, so the AMA was charged with coming up with some sort of schedule of prices, some sort of menu of things to be done, and a price tag on each one. And very rapidly, they came up with a document, which we still live with, which is a compendium of procedures that numbers about 10,000 and is pretty awkward to charge for each part of a treatment act.
But how does that change the doctor-patient relationship?
Well, there it turns out that that becomes very, very political in the true sense of the word political. How much is it worth? How much is anything that we do to you worth? Now, caring for you is very important, but now we're asking about how much is it worth to care for bits of you or parts of you or different events in the caring for you. It became so cumbersome that a group of economists and political scientists from Yale said we ought to charge for the product, which is a cluster of treatment events. And then the doctor said, well, wait a minute, there is no simple product. You can have an appendectomy, but it can be complicated. Or you can have two diseases, and it can be triple complicated. So the product became as complex as the procedural terminology, and now numbers in the 100,000 items.
But do doctors treat their patients any differently? I mean, do they not? How does that interaction that you say is so therapeutic and that we have lost, why was that changed because of this new schedule?
Because we parsed the Treatment Act so that what's left out of the Treatment Act is the trusting relationship. It has become possible for me to say something like it takes me about 20 seconds to write a prescription and about 20 minutes not to write a prescription. And the reason
because I have
is,
to talk to you.
The reason is I want us as a doctor-patient event to understand why we might, and to have your values come to play. It's the other edge of this sword, which is what happened to efficacy in the course of the past 40 years. But essentially what we've done is we've made coding and billing the driver for the Treatment Act to an extent now that's really quite a reduction to absurdity. We have developed computer programs that are very expensive that basically deal with these hundreds of thousands of potential coding events, each of which has a price tag.
Let me see if I can figure out what actually happens now in the examination room. Are doctors now looking for the code? Let's see. I can prescribe, based on what you've said, I could prescribe this medicine, that procedure, and this second visit, because I think that's all going to be covered by the insurance. Rather than sort of taking this person as a whole, I'm looking for the numbers and the check boxes that I can get checked off.
Yeah, I don't think the doctors have even the time to do that. And that's actually a gaming the system exercise that requires a lot of effort. However, every institution has coders who are trying to do that to make sure that we're not underbilling or overbilling and that we've coded correctly. And every doctor's office has about 60% overhead now that's involved in the coding and the submission of so we have at least about 5 to 8-fold the administrative costs in the American healthcare system of any other system. And all of that is going to operate the system. It becomes the infrastructure, transitions to being the superstructure.
And when time is money, that also then would reduce the amount of time I can spend because I've got this other overhead that I've got to account for.
That's part of it. Now, the next part of it is efficacy.
So, yeah, talk about that. I mean, if this drug is 30% effective at reducing cholesterol and having higher cholesterol raises your risk of heart attack by 18% or whatever that is, don't I just take the drug?
Well, you need much more information than that. And unfortunately, it takes time. When we started talking about this over a decade ago, it sounded totally counterintuitive. Now with the statins and cholesterol story, it's required much more inventiveness on part of the pharmaceutical industry to get you to take pills and now injections. The answer is you want to ask that question. What's in it for me? Now, you tell me you can lower my cholesterol, but what will happen that I'm going to be happy for since I don't know that my cholesterol is high until you told me? It didn't make me sleepy or itchy. It didn't cause any problems that I'm aware of. You tell me it imparts some risk for death before my time. How much risk? And what you'll discover is for most people told that they have a high cholesterol, we're talking about risks of death before my time measured in months, not in decades, in months. And can you reduce that risk is the next question. And the answer is, well, if I have an individual who has had no heart attack in the past, the answer is I can reduce that risk, but I can't change your life expectancy. That we can't save a life. What we can do is probably decrease your risk of a non-fatal heart attack. So you ask, by how much? And I say, well, that's a difficult thing to sort through when you're looking at statistics. How do I explain that to you? By a smidgen. Well, I could tell you that if I gave it to 60 or 100 middle-aged men, and they took it and they every day for 5 years, of the 100, maybe 2 would be spared a non-fatal heart attack. Now, once you've gotten that far, and by the way, this conversation needs to be had for a tremendous number of interventions in American medicine right now, and the reason is they've been licensed, and they've been licensed because there is a benefit. But nobody is asking out loud how much benefit, at what personal cost, meaning is it likely to cause me a problem, and then as a nation, at what fiscal cost. And if we start to ask those questions, we will have a very different doctor-patient relationship. Right now, we've turned health into a commodity and disease into a product line, and the doctors are the sales force.
How would that change?
That's unconscionable.
I haven't left you too much time, but this is the part in which we ask the critic to tell us how it would look better and what we need to do.
Well, there are two answers to that, and we don't have time for the second one. The first okay. one I will give you, and then I will give you a hint of the second okay. one. The first answer is we can't change the American healthcare system. It is morally bankrupt. It has a very rusty moral compass. It is unconscionably expensive. It does very little compared to all of our sister countries for the patient. But it is supported by the entropy of a tremendous percentage of the GDP and an enormous number of corporate entities, who are all of which say there's a real problem, but it's the other guy that caused it. And I tell you that from having tried in a couple of instances in the past 25 years, because I've been trying to answer that question actively for 25 years. When I wrote By the Bedside of the Patient, as is true for all books with university presses, they were sent out to blind reviewers, and we had 3 blind reviewers, and 2 of them said it's terrific, and the 3rd said it's terrific, and said here's 8 single-spaced pages of suggestions, one of which was, and by the way, I rewrote extensively because the suggestions were excellent, but one was, what next? And I talk in the book, in one chapter, in response to the reviewer about a program we've been working on for a decade quite actively. And as of a month ago, we got a green light. It's a way to rethink benefits. The way we think about benefits in this country is that there's health insurance and there's compensation insurance and there's disability insurance and there's life. But all of that is a throwback to legislation that was generated in Prussia a century ago. And it really makes far less sense today. We ought to be able to provide benefits for all of us, and they shouldn't be contested, and they should be easy, and they should be for your benefit. And so we have found a crack in the wall of the legislation in one of the states that allows us to rethink the notion of benefits. And we can do that with a defined contribution plan, a certain amount of money, predictable. It's actually quite small if you get rid of the administrative overhead and some of the total overtreatment. It need not be that large. In fact,
single payer, single system.
Single payer is a euphemism.
Is there private insurance involved, or the government is a socialized? You know, the communists.
You're using all the terms that have been used politically for most of my.
Is that the communist plot?
That actually was what Hayek and what the AMA. That's how we got the term socialized medicine. The answer is, the only way we could do this was to build on the system as we have it. So it's a form of employer-based benefits that is designed for very large employers, such as the state government or a big box employer. It's not designed for small employers. It requires 2% of wages for everybody, plus a multiple from the employer. And at the end of the year of this 8% of wages, by the way, that's trivial for an entry-level employee.
I know, but they're going to have to read your book to find out more, because I got to go.
It's a deal.
But it's a pleasure talking with you all the time. Dr. Norton Hadler, Emeritus Professor of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. His latest book is called By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physician. It has some answers in there, and you can read all about it in his books. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, and we have details on that at our website, stateofthings.org. Stay with us. There's more to come on The State of Things.